Welcome to Playmakers Talk Show, where business owners, professionals, and entrepreneurs gather to discover playmaking ideas for success. Your host is internationally recognized speaker, facilitator, and author, Steve Klein, who sits down with fascinating playmakers who have made themselves and their company successful. Steve will introduce you to CEOs and executives who discuss their playmaking path toward success. And now, it's time to meet this show's playmaker. Here's your host, Steve Klein.
Janet Dickens said, "The wings of transformation are born of patience and struggle." Welcome, Playmakers Talk Show. I'm Steve Klein. In the studio today is a guest who is patient in efforts to transform his industry. Today's Playmaker eliminates variation in emergency medical services to improve quality and lower cost. With us today is a chief medical officer who set out to transform the future of emergency medicine on a bar napkin. This great playmaker is Dr. Nick Zenarosa. Nick is founder and chief medical officer of Integrative Emergency Services. Dr. Zenarosa is a visionary behind Integrative Emergency Services. His mission is to improve the way healthcare is practiced across the continuum, driven by his passion to enhance the role of emergency medicine in value-based healthcare. He's intent on maintaining the value system that drives a culture of excellence in this physician-led organization. IES manages more than 500 physicians and advanced practitioners for facilities including 15 emergency departments across the Baylor Scott & White Health System, as well as John Peter Smith Hospital in Fort Worth. Nick's career in emergency medicine began in 1995. Since then, he has served as both faculty and attending staff at multiple teaching and trauma centers throughout Texas and is currently practicing at Baylor University Medical Center at Dallas, John Peter Smith Hospital, and Baylor Scott & White Medical Center of McKinney. Well, Nick, welcome to Playmakers Talk Show.
Well, thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. Quotation I had seen, I want to ask you about this. It's really trying to figure out a new way to deliver healthcare because the way we do it now doesn't work. So my question is, why doesn't it work?
I think it really goes back to how healthcare has transitioned in its reimbursement structure. Where my father was an internist for decades. He unfortunately passed away in 2010, but he was 84 years old at the time and still practiced internal medicine. So he was a solo practitioner in internal medicine his entire career, and he started off seeing a certain number of patients before Medicare was started. Medicare came about, and he had to increase the volume within his practice to maintain, quite frankly, the same amount of income as it did before Medicare. So with that increased volume came less time to spend with each patient. He had to increase his overhead to do the billing and collecting. But because he had to see so many more people in his outpatient office, he no longer followed patients when they went into the hospital. And it was difficult once they left the hospital for him to even know they were in the hospital and that they needed to be followed up back in his office. So that's just a small example of how healthcare has become siloed and fractured in terms of delivery. So you have all these great specialists now. You have health systems. And the only thing that goes horizontally is the patient.
Over the last 12 months, I'm sure that's changed even more so because of the pandemic.
I think that not only has the silos been maintained, but I think patients have decreased in-person access to healthcare, and they've delayed care. So we are now seeing a significant increase in higher morbidity for certain conditions and higher deaths. You can pick up any newspaper and see that patients are delaying a diagnosis of a lump somewhere that turns out to be an advanced stage cancer by the time they do seek care.
Would you say that they just don't feel they have access to the physician anymore?
I think that is ubiquitous in healthcare as a whole, is that because of the silos and the fracturing of healthcare delivery, that you subsequently have decreased access. And again, since a lot of healthcare today is volume dependent, our physicians have to maintain full schedules, packed to the gills. So for them to try to see an extra patient per day even can be very challenging.
Well, you grew up in Southern Illinois. You went to school in the Chicago area. I understand your dad was a physician. Was he the only one in your family that went into medicine?
No. So my younger sister also is an emergency physician up in Indianapolis area. And she is the second best doctor in the family right now. But both of us grew up when medicine was very different than it is today. Again, grew up in southern Illinois. My father was a well-known internist in Belleville, Illinois. And it was fun because even as a kid, 5, 6 years old, I would go with him to make rounds because he was always at the at the office or the hospital. So if we want to hang out with my dad, it wasn't fishing trips; it was making rounds in the hospital. So I got to see a very different form of healthcare delivery, literally back in the 70s, early 70s, and even maybe the late 60s, where I would go with him to the hospital on Sundays. And he'd walk me into the nurse's station. First thing I notice is there may be people sitting there smoking while they're doing their charts, and whether it be nurses or doctors or patients. And then I'd walk into the rooms with him to see the patients. There was no HIPAA back then. So I'd walk in, and he'd examine and interview a patient right there with me. You know, Mrs. Jones, this is my son, Nikki. He's going to hang out with me today, and how you doing? And so I'd literally make rounds with my dad when I was very, very young. And then I got to follow him into the doctor's lounge, which is like this sacred club in the hospital to some. But really, what I've learned now, it was vital in terms of referrals, in terms of getting extra information from consultants. So I can't tell you how many times I'd be with him in the doctor's lounge, and he'd walk over to the board. Every doctor had their own number, and they had a light switch they would turn on to let other doctors know they were in the hospital. And so he'd walk over and start looking at the light board and say, oh, well, my favorite vascular surgeon's here. And so then he'd have someone do an overhead page if that doctor was not in the lounge. And then he'd go talk to that doctor directly. Hey, I have Mrs. Jones upstairs. I'm worried that she might have X, Y, and Z. Can you look in on her? And that's really, it was very collegial. It was a very tight-knit medical community. But my dad was the navigator horizontally between all the different service lines of healthcare at the time. Patients knew that he would see them in his office. He would be the admitting doctor in the hospital. He'd organize all the consultants, and when they were discharged from the hospital, he'd see them back in the office whenever he needed to see them, and they could call him. People knew where he lived. I remember one time the sheriff came over. My dad was actually in the shower, and the sheriff just walked in the bathroom, started talking to my dad, asking him about some of his symptoms. And so my dad was that healthcare navigator. So quite frankly, what we've tried to do in some ways with our groups, is to help go horizontally in healthcare now for a much larger volume of patients, obviously. But that's what an emergency doc does anyhow. A patient shows up in the emergency department through various mechanisms. They drive themselves in. Their doctor asks them to come in. The ambulance brings them. The employer sends them, whatever. They arrive, and we know they're coming. We just don't know their name. They show up in the emergency department. And then our doctors and our specialty are the master diagnosticians of healthcare because we deal every patient, every type of condition, every stage of those diseases, every time of day, 24/7. And then we have to figure out a disposition and sometimes a diagnosis of those patients. And then we have to transition that next level of care.
In listening to what you just said, the word humanity came to mind. What I hear you saying is you're putting humanity back into the medical profession for the patient.
That's a great way to describe it. We in addition to being master diagnosticians and clinicians, we have to be masters at forming a relationship in seconds to minutes because we see such high volumes of patients. We have to strike up a conversation relationship and build trust and demonstrate empathy almost immediately because we're going to be seeing your stroke, your heart attack, your gunshot wound, your stub toe, your cold, your sick kid, your whatever, right? And there's a lot of social issues we see that people are very skittish of trusting anybody. We see, you know, up to 5% of everyone that walks in an emergency department is a victim of human trafficking, right? And so talk about, you know, being in a predatory environment, those folks, whether it be, you know, labor trafficking or sex trafficking. So our physicians and our APPs are uniquely positioned to form relationships very quickly and trust very quickly and kind of navigate that patient through healthcare.
So the medical degree aside, you're looking for those who, using the word you just said, are able to develop relationships very quickly to be able to use their medical proficiency to help that person. And then going beyond that, it sounds like, to help them with their life in addition to whatever they're there for.
So you're absolutely correct. So 80% of our patients go home, if you think about it. So 20% get admitted to the hospital, 80% go home. And it's not uncommon, I mean, personally and even organizationally, once someone leaves the emergency department, we don't cease that relationship. We'll call them. We'll make sure they're okay. We try to find out, make sure they followed up with those doctors that we referred them to. We'll give disclaimers in our phone numbers and cards, say, if you can't get in to see this doctor, call us back or call me back or come back to the emergency department.
You're almost going back to the days prior to my being born when doctors actually went to for home visits. Now, you're not doing that, but you're implementing the same style of practicing medicine with your patients. They're coming into emergency rooms.
So it's interesting you say that because we actually are going out to patients, right? And we don't make house calls. Necessarily, we make street calls. So we have a homeless medicine, a street medicine program over at John Peter Smith Hospital in Fort Worth. I want to do a quick correction. In addition to the Baylor Scott & White system and John Peter Smith system, we're proud to say we've also started helping and working and partnering in the Catholic Health Initiatives, the Baylor St. Luke's system, CHI, down in Houston too. And so it's been a lot of fun. We started April 1st right during the pandemic, so it's been a challenge. But back to the house call, we reach out now. Instead of waiting for patients coming to us, we've now, in the last probably 2 years, started going out to patients. So we started a community health paramedicine program. If you think about it, our paramedics, our workforce that's always at the ready, and it's been very episodic in the past, but they have a very high skill set and the ability to assess patients, the sickest to the least sick. So we've worked with numerous fire departments to help them develop community health paramedicine programs where they will send paramedics out to visit people who are vulnerable patients and potentially high utilizers of episodic care. And there's some great results from that. More recently, a couple of our doctors, Dr. Chad and Katie Holmes out in Fort Worth at our John Peter Smith Flagship Hospital in Fort Worth, developed a street medicine program in conjunction with our family medicine partners out there. And they actually follow approximately 300 patients that are homeless. And what's interesting is half of those patients kind of go in and out of homelessness, depend on paycheck to paycheck. The other half stay homeless. So it's really focused on that fringe of our patient populations that are the most vulnerable in many different ways.
Again, you used relationship as a word a little while ago, but you also mentioned follow-up, which is what I teach salespeople to do with their clients, which they do not do as often as they should. The fact that your physicians are following up with patients is, to me, almost unheard of in the medical field.
Yeah. So it's initially, quite frankly, started off more so for patient satisfaction, right? Is we have done numerous surveys. We would survey a patient while they're in the emergency department, and 95% of the time, they would say they had excellent, outstanding care. You ask that same patient a month or two later and, you know, what they thought their care was, and it would drop sometimes significantly, like half, okay, being satisfied. And one of the reasons we found, or some of the reasons why, it wasn't the actual ED encounter, okay? It was the post-ED visit where they try to get a prescription filled, okay? They try to get a follow-up appointment. They got a bill, okay? And suddenly things just plummeted. So we started making phone calls to make sure the patient understood their discharge instructions. They were able to get a follow-up appointment. They were able to get their prescription filled. And if they fulfilled those three things, their satisfaction was much higher. But what we also found were there were things that the condition they presented to the emergency department with initially had deteriorated. And so we said, hey, it sounds like you got worse. You need to come back. And when I trained, I did two residencies, one in internal medicine at Parkland here in Dallas, and the other at Carolina's Medical Center in Charlotte, North Carolina. And one of our attendings in Charlotte's phenomenal physician and an attorney named Bob Bitterman. And, you know, he, you know, said every shift you're going to have patients that you're not quite sure of that should they've come in or should they go home. He says, just call them. He said, there's nothing forbidden for the doctor to call the patient and ask them how they're doing. And so that's what we've done now for decades. And our hospital partners have absolutely supported it and encouraged it and set up structures to make sure we can do that.
We're speaking with Dr. Nick Zanarosa. Dr. Zanarosa has a company called Integrative Emergency Services. The website is ies.healthcare. Question that just came up as you had mentioned that, Nick, is to do what you're doing with your physicians, you must have an awful lot of training to keep them up to speed in terms of how to develop that relationship with a patient and what to do to keep them informed. Is that correct?
So, yeah, I'm not so sure we've got formal training in relationship building, but we have excellent ability to give feedback, both positive and negative, from patients to our providers.
So what you're doing is you are almost completing the gap between their physician and the emergency room to keep everybody informed. So do your doctors actually work with their physician, the patient's physician, or just contacting the patient?
Referring back to the way healthcare used to be practiced, a patient had a physician relationship that would go with them kind of horizontally through the healthcare delivery system. Now, I think, again, there's much more fractured delivery of care and silos of care. Emergency medicine also, same way, we see someone that comes in the emergency department, they leave, and quite frankly, the traditional emergency medicine relationship stops when they get discharged. We give very generic forms of referrals, if you would. Follow up with your doctor next available. Follow up in 5 to 7 days. Follow up in 1 to 3 days. When we're really worried about them, we may pick up the phone and call a specialist or that primary care doctor. But we don't do a great job right now of transitioning that patient from the ED visit back to their primary care. Okay, I think we could do a lot better.
But it also sounds like you are doing whatever you can to keep that patient from coming back to you.
The reasons patients come back to us isn't always because they got sicker. It's to the point you mentioned earlier, is there's less access to care. But I also think patient culture's changed over the years. So there's really multiple things probably going on, but two streams of change that I can see is that the practice patterns in healthcare have become fractured for the reasons we talked about. But then patients, okay, have really become more consumers, right? And if you look at the number of hours in a week, let's say, about 168 hours in a week, if a primary care doctor works 12-hour days, 5 days a week, that's really only about 35% of the potential hours of demand. So the other 65% of those hours of demand are nights and weekends, right? And so emergency medicine is always open. We're 24/7. We've got a ton of resources at our fingertips. So as patients transition, you know, my age group and above, we still think like patients. Well, the doctor said they can see me next week for my chest pain. Okay, well, I'm fine with that. Okay, fine. My grandma, who's 101 years old, lives in an apartment now, independent living, same way. Well, my doctor said, you know, it's fine. They can see me next week. And I'm like, no, grandma, you need to go now. But some of our younger patients, they're not used to waiting. Okay. And they want it now. right? And we do that everywhere else in our society. If I want, 2 o'clock in the morning, if I want to order new socks, I can go on Amazon and get my socks, or I can go to 7-Eleven and get a great cup of coffee. I can go grocery shopping 24/7. Healthcare is going the same way. A lot of our healthcare delivery is because people have questions, so I can get questions answered on a FaceTime or a telephone or telemedicine. So I think healthcare delivery has to change, because patients aren't the traditional patient in the sense of their expectations. They're now more consumers. You've got to be able to have, I think, a 24/7 solution, and emergency medicines are filled that role. Instead of acute unscheduled care visits, we call them all ER visits. But if you look at the number of ER visits in the United States pre-COVID, about 155 million. And there's, 350 million people in the country. You've got a workforce that's available 24/7 that are master diagnosticians and clinicians that build relationships quickly. We have a lot of bells and whistles available to us when we're in the emergency department. You've got a market that is now on demand, okay? I don't want to wait. And so emergency medicine volumes have gone up over the years, not necessarily because there's more emergencies, because there's a different type of demand than there used to be.
What is your vision for where you're taking IES? What comes next? How do you build on the success you've had so far?
I think we will continue. Our knitting is still staffing. Our core business is, we are a staffing organization. We staff emergency departments and urgent cares and some other venues. Once we have a relationship for staffing, then we will continue to drive excellence and make quality our focus to decrease the variation in care by practicing evidence-based medicine. The result of that will then be better clinical outcomes, which we've documented numerous times through peer-reviewed journals and grants, et cetera, et cetera. But it also lowers your costs, overall costs. And the reason why is you're ordering tests for specific reasons, not necessarily defensive medicine, but very good stewardship and high-value medicine. So we'll continue to do that. But then you got this phenomenal workforce called emergency medicine right now that really can start answering the call for other ways to deliver healthcare, which is on demand. We have a telemedicine platform that, quite frankly, COVID accelerated, because we lost initially so much volume in the emergency departments, 40% decrease of our patient volume. We had doctors and APPs sitting around wanting to do something. So we accelerated our telemedicine platform. So instead of waiting for patients to come to us, we could reach out if we needed to. And our EMS partners have really gravitated toward this. So we're bringing emergency medicine skill sets out through telemedicine. So that's an example of using the emergency medicine workforce for what may be considered non-traditional emergency medicine work.
So you must have spent a lot of time recruiting or looking for the right kind of emergency facilities to have the right kind of people to deal with the patients.
We haven't had to do a lot of recruiting, because we all have our own personal networks. And so a lot of it's been word of mouth. We don't advertise. We've been 98% recruited now for years and years and years. And what's fun is we don't have any outside investors. We don't answer to Wall Street, and we work very collegially with insurance companies to be a network and so forth and so on. We can, we have a high performing organization that doesn't require gregarious billing schemes or anything like that. It's pretty straightforward stuff. So because of that, most of the money we collect goes back to doctors and APPs. Our overhead is exceptionally low. Our retention rate is incredibly high, and the doctors and the APPs, we show them very transparently what our goals and objectives are, but also their performance. So it's fun for a lot of our docs, because we're competitive by nature. So I want the best clinical. I want to beat the doctor next to me on my clinical outcomes. And it's fun to be in publications. It's very professionally fulfilling. So a great example, a couple great examples, where, you know, we have multiple sites. You've got hundreds of providers. We see a ton of patients, hundreds of thousands of patients. And to show globally that we could decrease opiate prescriptions by 70% across the board and maintain it is phenomenal, because every time we prescribe narcotics in the emergency department, there's a certain percent of those people that transition to being addicted to them, and the downstream impacts are huge. To show that we could implement a sepsis protocol and just kick the crud out of mortality rates to the point where you can now put names, hundreds of people that should have died, didn't die, and they're out walking around now, is pretty cool. And that's just two initiatives. We got 40 of them, right? And so now to turn the emergency medicine platform as a screening tool for human trafficking is pretty cool. 85% of everyone that's being trafficked goes to the emergency room because they don't want to risk, the handlers don't want to risk being discovered. So they may try to sneak into one of our little rural emergency departments, but, you know, we're on it.
Two questions. One, how do our listeners find out more about you? That's number one. And again, should they need emergency services, where should they go?
If you're in a familiar city, local forces will tell you, you know, their impression of where you should go. When I tell family and friends, if you're in an unknown region or environment within the United States, I'd go to a trauma center. And one of the reasons why, those hospitals are leveled, if you would, according to resources available. So a level two or level one, level three, two or one trauma center should have pretty exceptional services available 24/7. We are partial, and we love our hospital partners. And, you know, if you're in the Dallas-Fort Worth or Houston area, I'd certainly go to John Peter Smith Hospital with zero hesitation. Just got voted number one hospital in the United States by a nationally recognized journal. And then Baylor Scott & White Health is excellent. And then our partners in Houston at CHI, St. Luke's Baylor, are outstanding.
Well, Nick, thank you very much for being a part of Playmakers Talk Show. This was absolutely fascinating. Thank you again.
Thank you.
We're speaking with Dr. Nick Zenarosa. He is founder and chief medical officer of Integrative Emergency Services. Should you like to find out more about his company, it's IES.healthcare. This has been a terrific show. Again, we just spoke with Dr. Nick Zenarosa. Thank you to Nick for being a Playmaker. It's been great having you on the show, and thanks to all of you for listening and joining us. Join us again at PlaymakersTalkShow.com, where you can get all of our past episodes. That's PlaymakersTalkShow.com, and we'll be back with more Playmakers. See you then.
You've been listening to Playmakers Talk Show with Steve Klein. Join Steve again at PlaymakersTalkShow.com for more interviews with interesting and successful playmaking CEOs and executives.